Hi, my name is Danielle, and you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this podcast, we discuss subjects that might be creepy to some and sometimes even frightening. Some of our episodes will deal with serious subject matter, while others will be more lighthearted. Please keep in mind that I am not an expert on any of the topics I cover, just an interested party, and as always, listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone, I'm Danielle.
And I'm Corey.
And you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this week's episode, we're going to Northern Ontario to a place formerly called New Liskard and now known as Timiskaming Shores. And we will be discussing the disappearance of Melanie Etier. I think that we've all heard of people going missing under mysterious circumstances, and this case is definitely one of those. But when you hear the expression missing without a trace, it describes exactly what happened to Melanie, because in a lot of ways it seems like she just dropped off the face of the earth. Melanie Nadia Etier was born in December 1980 and was living in New Liskard in Northern Ontario. She was a Christmas baby born on December 25th. She lived with her mom and a younger sister. According to the OPP Investigative Lens documentary, Melanie was 15 when she went missing. She was, by all accounts, a good kid that hung out with other good kids and that did well in school. She was described by friends as friendly and outgoing. On September 28, 1996, Melanie and her friends had been out and about in town that day. It was a Saturday and school would have just started a few weeks before, and Melanie had started the 11th grade. According to one of the investigators on the case, Lisa Laxton, Melanie had been busy doing normal teenage things with her friends. They were hanging out, shopping, just being regular teenagers. Around 10 p.m. that night, Melanie arrived at her house with her friends in tow. Melanie's mom was at home, and she told her mom that they were going to watch some movies and asked if she and her friends could watch a movie in her room. Her mom reminded her of how messy her room was, and Melanie said to her friends, "Okay, let's go, guys." According to her mother, she said these words with a smile and appeared to be in a good mood. Her mother recounts watching her walk away, and in the documentary, her mother says that usually she would never do that. She sort of says this without context, so I took it to mean that she just let the kids leave at 10 p.m.
Oh, so the mom let them leave, not that the daughter walked away.
Right, so, okay. And again, there's really no context. She just kind of says that sentence that she would never have done that, and the mother says it like towards herself, okay. But she doesn't give context to what she's actually referring to.
Well, she's 15 and it's 10 o'clock at night.
So that's what I took it to mean, that normally she would have said, messy room or not, just hang out here, it's 10 p.m. So I get the impression that normally she would have let the kids stay at her place to watch the movie.
Well, too, if that's like the last interaction she's going to have, it will probably weigh pretty heavily on her mind forever, basically.
Yeah, this would be the last time she saw her daughter. At 15... going on 16, how much leeway would you have had in terms of curfew and being out and about with your friends?
Well, I grew up in a small town of like, I think in those days it was 4,000 or 5,000 people.
I don't know how big this town is, but I'm pretty sure it's quite small. I forgot to check, but I don't think it's a large...
Well, it was renamed, right?
Yeah.
It's probably a small town.
It's because
town.
It amalgamated.
Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, small town. I was a really good kid. I didn't get up to much. I probably would be just doing something at a friend's house.
But how much freedom? Like, what, did you have a curfew?
Sort of depended on the night, I think.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think 10 o'clock probably would be realistic for 15 for me, I think.
Yeah, I think after, I know at one point my curfew was midnight, but I think that was just in 12th grade. So I think up to 12th grade, it would have been like 10 or 11 p.m.
Yeah.
But I do remember the whole... especially that early in the year when you wouldn't have had homework or anything like that or nothing pressing. I do remember those days of literally spending the whole day with friends.
Well, I grew up in a small subdivision, so like we almost never left our subdivision when I was out playing with my friends. We'd usually be at somebody's house watching TV. I think if I was at a friend's house, I probably would have had to call and say, hey, we're watching a movie. I'll be home soon. 2-minute walk home. Like, yeah.
Okay. See, I grew up in a bit of a different situation because I grew up in a tiny place that has like, I don't know, 500 people, maybe. But I didn't have friends within walking distance. And it was a really, like, everyone lived on a main road. So the traffic would be coming by really quick. So my sister did have a friend nearby. So I know sometimes she'd walk back from there. So it'd be maybe a 5-minute walk. But for myself, I had to travel to the next town over. So I'd always be getting a drive home. So there'd always be a time set of when someone was picking me up, unless I was staying over.
Yeah, I mean, I lived 5-6 houses away. I grew up in a pretty safe place.
Yeah.
Without traffic.
So Melanie left at 10 p.m. with her friends, seemingly to go watch the movies. Melanie and the group of friends, and I don't know the specific number that the group was, the way they talk about different things happening through the evening, I think there were at least 3 more people, but I don't know for a fact how many people there were. But they head over to another friend's house to watch the movies, which I think is, again, pretty typical of being 15 and doing like a movie marathon at 10 o'clock at night. Around 12:30 that night, one person from the group decides to leave because they need to catch a ride home. So apparently this person lived in the next little town over. This friend would later say that they were surprised and frightened by a strange car that was idling nearby, to the point that when they left the house, they actually ran to where they were going. So I don't know if they were being picked up at another house or like down the road. They had to meet someone. There's no detail of that. But they actually, when they saw the car, it scared them enough to run. But there's really not much more information about this vehicle. According to all accounts, Melanie stayed at her friend's house another hour or so before leaving for home. So this puts us at about 1:30 in the morning on September 29th. Her friends would say that they walked her to the door and watched her head down Pine Street East, which would have been going towards her house. She had about a 1-kilometer walk to make it home, so that would be like under 15 minutes.
About that, yeah.
Years later, a witness came forward saying that they'd actually seen Melanie on the bridge that was just several hundred yards from her house, and that would officially become her last known sighting.
Oof, that's close.
Yeah.
That's like 4 houses close.
Yeah. The next morning, Melanie's alarm went off, waking up her mother. And I think we all remember alarm clocks from the 80s forward that were blaring and would wake up the whole household. Her mom got up and went into Melanie's room to turn off the blaring alarm clock and noticed that Melanie wasn't home. I suspect that this happened pretty early because her mother just says that she turned off the alarm and went back to bed and she wasn't feeling worried because she said that sometimes Melanie would just fall asleep at a friend's house and spend the night there. So I suspect she was given quite a bit of freedom to kind of come and go as long as her mom had an idea of where she was going, which I don't think is unusual. I feel like my parents were pretty strict about stuff like that, but a lot of my friends didn't have the same rules as I did.
No, that was totally an option for me as a kid, just be like, hey, you know, it's late, I'm tired, I'm just going to crash here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would have been fine with that.
As the day went on, there was no sign of Melanie. I'm sure the worry was mounting as the day progressed, and it all came to a head when Melanie didn't show up for her babysitting job that afternoon. Her mother then called the police. The local police were originally contacted, but they in turn ended up calling the Ontario Provincial Police because they had more resources. So it does sound like they really didn't waste much time getting...
Which is nice to hear for once in one of these stories.
Yeah, so they... I think in Canada it's fairly common, like past the mid-90s, that police actually did react quite quickly. There was almost 500 officers and volunteers that would be searching for Melanie. And they even searched the waterways, but they came up with nothing. Not a single trace of her was found.
Wow.
According to the police, it's a strange case for them because they're quite certain that she met with foul play. And I'm not sure if they have holdback evidence indicating this or if they're just basing this on the circumstances surrounding the case. But They do think that she met with foul play, but there's no crime scene that exists. There's no crime scene to work, which makes it hard to find any clues at all that would lead to her whereabouts or answer the question of what happened.
Well, I mean, if she's a happy kid and has a good home life and her friends know where she's at or knew where she was at, like, it's, you could only think foul play, I think, in that situation. Like, she's not going to run away from home. Like, and if, again, if she has a, if she has a happy home life, she's not going to run off. She's obviously free to roam and hang out with her friends and everything. I don't, that does not sound like an unhappy kid with unruly parents.
Right. By all accounts, there was nothing of significance to make anyone think that she would be a runaway. She didn't seem to be involved with anything that would lead her to maybe run away, like a boyfriend in another town or another community or drugs or anything like that. Or like you say, just an unhappy home life. It sounds like she was just a typical teenager, kind of just enjoying life.
Well, if she was in like a car, like she was struck by a car or something, like there's no, the lack of evidence only really can point you in one direction.
And that's one theory that did come up, that she may have been struck by a car and then people panicked and just hit her body. But there's no evidence of that.
I mean, either. That is an accident, but that's still foul play because you're hiding the body, yes, right?
So. Absolutely. But yeah, there's no evidence of this. So through the years, there's been tips and there's been leads, possibly even persons of interest that are mentioned, but the case remains unsolved. And whatever tips are coming in, the police aren't sharing that information.
And this is in 96?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they share the information at this point?
I'm not sure. It happens. There's actually, I started researching the case for next week as well, and the same thing is happening. Like, it's a very cold case from the early 2000s, so it's over 15 years old, and they're just not releasing all of the information.
I mean, if nobody's working on it, like, still actively investigating it, then there wouldn't be somebody worried about it or still thinking about it enough to sort of release the information.
I just feel like there might be circumstances, like if you have a person of interest that you're pretty certain did it, but you just can't, you don't have enough evidence on them, I could see why you wouldn't release the information. But other than that, like if you don't have anyone in your sights, I don't understand why the bulk of the information, maybe barring a thing or two, wouldn't be released or talked about. Because the public sometimes knows things that they don't know they know. And it just takes a little something to nudge that memory or that realization.
Yeah, I suppose. It's just hard to think of, like, you know, somebody's actively working on it. People looking for answers, like, could they release the information they do have and omit the information about the persons of interest? Or I guess that wouldn't really give anybody any fulfilling information anyways, because you are looking for justice, I guess, but...
They actually talk about that in a 2015 CBC article, because the police actually say that they're holding on to some information that could be vital in helping them catch whoever's responsible for the crime. But they actually interviewed some criminologists in this article, and they disagree. They say it's a good idea for the first months and maybe even the first few years, but past that, it's not helpful. If you want to trigger any memories, if you want the public to be interested and involved, you need to release the information.
Yeah, I mean, what feels right for the police might not be right for the situation.
And whether you agree or disagree about how the police handled the evidence on the case, Melanie remains missing 24 years after her disappearance, and she deserves to be found. And from what's released publicly that we can see, there's really nothing to go on.
It is weird to think that a person can just and completely vanish.
Completely vanish. It's those cases I find so difficult when the person was just like stone's throw distance from their destination, and just like that, they're gone.
Well, like 100 yards. Like, that's crazy.
I remember being way too young to be reading it, but I read Stranger Beside Me by Anne Rule, which is about Ted Bundy. And there's one co-ed that disappeared who was literally walking between two buildings, like leaving one and going into the next, and she went missing.
Wow.
And that always kind of stayed with me about how quickly things can happen. Her mother says something that was really heartbreaking in the documentary. She says that the years with her daughter missing have just been like a very long funeral. She said that she does not believe that her daughter's still alive. She felt quite quickly that her daughter had passed.
Well, it's like that woman must have no closure. She doesn't have, she can't bury this, her kid. She can't do a cremation. There's nothing. Like, there's literally no closure for that woman at all.
Quoting from a globalnews.ca article from 2017 where she says, "I felt numb for the first 2.5 years that I was searching to find her. I did everything I could to look everywhere I could think of. I did as much media coverage as I could to try to find her," end quote. And at one point, there's only so much you can do.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's doing all the right things. Like, you can only, by doing media coverage, you're trying to get people to talk. You're trying to keep it fresh in people's minds. You know, eventually the story's going to fizzle out because the next big thing is what is going to make the news. It's not like this mother can have a nightly segment about her child. And public interest is going to wane over time along with police interest, you know. It's
other things happen that they need to work on.
She can't create evidence out of nothing.
No. I feel it's very unfortunate with all these missing person cases. We talk about how people are so involved. There's volunteers, there's people out looking. But after a while, where do you look? Where do you keep searching? What do you do? And I know sometimes they do anniversary coverage when the year rolls around or it's been 5 years or 10 years, but I don't know. It just doesn't feel like enough. I don't know what could be done differently. I don't have the answer to that, but it just doesn't feel like enough.
Well, like in terms of media, like, well, the media is going to move on. People are going to move on too. Like, yeah. It's, I can't search today. I feel like it's not getting anywhere, or I have to go back to work, or there's any number of things that draw people away from that, those investigations and helping. And then again, with the police, it's the next new case. So it's the sad part of it is all these missing person cases that they don't find anything. It's going to be a really drawn out process with a good likelihood of no answer, which is really sad.
It's very unfortunate. I do understand the reasons why it happens. And again, I don't have an answer on how to make it better. I just wish there was something. The police really believe that someone holds the answer to what happened to Melanie, and the case does remain open. There is a $50,000 reward offered in this case. So at the time of her disappearance, Melanie was 15 years old, so she'd be 39 today. If you do have any information, you should call the OPP. Her mother would like to put her daughter to rest.
It's terrible. It's that weird thing too, like, you know, you grew up in a small town. I don't think you ever felt unsafe in it. I didn't.
Sometimes I was scared, but that's just because I read too many Stephen King novels. It wasn't anything realistic that I was afraid of.
Yeah, same here. Like, it's scared of the boogeyman. That's about it. Wandering around the woods at night without a flashlight. Yeah, that's pretty terrifying.
Haunted cars were not actually things that happen.
Yeah, but not to take anything away from anybody, that any families that are missing people, like missing kids, though, like, that's the worst.
Yeah. I think it's that idea of they had all their lives ahead. There was so much potential, and it just never got.
Well, the notion of parents having to say goodbye to their kids, when it should be the other way around, right?
Yeah. We're going to finish up tonight with a moment of kindness. There's an employee at my place of work who has been making masks since the beginning of the pandemic. She's one of the nicest and sweetest people you've ever met, and pretty much the whole staff where I work wears the masks that she makes. She does charge a few dollars for them, but I've heard her utter the phrase, "Don't worry, you can pay me whenever," more times than I can actually count. I'm quite certain that on several occasions she's not gotten paid for her masks, but she just keeps making them and bringing them to work. And
oh, that's my mask.
Yes, that's your mask.
Yeah, I switched all that, her mask, over all those crappy store-made ones.
Yeah. I just feel like the world needs more people like her, just quietly helping out without asking for anything really in return. She's just one of those employees that everyone turns to, everyone talks to. She's always there for advice or kind word. She's a really good person. So that's all for tonight. As always, thanks to everyone that's been listening. I'd also like to thank everyone who's reached out to me to share their personal stories and experiences with the cases that I've covered. I'm very touched that people took the time to reach out to me, so thank you. If you have a story you'd like to share, a moment of kindness, or a case you'd like to see covered, please reach out at Crime and Mystery Canada on Instagram, or you can contact us at crimeandmysterycanada@gmail.com or join our Facebook group. I hope everyone is staying safe out there. Have a good night.
Have a good night. Stay safe.